Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, NME, Spotify, and Viagogo. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
I can't remember how to do podcasts. Do I just say hello back to you? Is that how it works?
You, this is sort of a free-for-all now. You can do what you like.
Hi!
Oh, hello.
That's what I like.
You were alluding there to the fact that we were not here last week.
We took an impromptu week off.
By which you mean it was your fault.
Well, you say it was my fault.
Because it was.
It wasn't completely my fault in that.
I'm just going back over what happened again. Yeah, it was.
With hindsight.
With hindsight, it was your fault.
With hindsight.
I was perfectly ready to record.
It was perhaps a little bit ambitious in a week where I was doing the very first and brilliant Artist Entrepreneur Day in Cambridge on the Thursday. Mm-hmm. I was then immediately going to Heathrow to fly to Oslo to deliver the Dissecting the Digital Dollar lecture at the brilliant BLARM in Oslo. Mm. Did I say Oslo twice in that sentence?
Probably.
It was in Oslo. And fitting in a podcast around that was probably a little bit ambitious, but it is true that I did intend to take my little recording device and my microphone with me to Oslo in order to record in my hotel room. But whereas when we went to Kiev,
The royal we.
Well, there were other people there. I mean, all the people who live in Kiev were there, for starters.
They didn't go to Kiev. They were already there.
Well, they might live on the outskirts in the suburbs, and they sort of went to Kiev for the thing. Anyway, the time I went to Kiev, I had quite a lot of time in my schedule while I was there. I also had quite a plush hotel room that was like nicely carpeted with a big curtains and stuff. So that all sort of worked. And so I think that's what gave me the confidence. I'll do the same in Oslo. I'll record the podcast in Oslo. But I forgot my kit, so that didn't work for starters.
Yeah.
It was the microphone, really, because had I had my microphone, I could have probably done it on my phone, but I didn't have a mic. I would like it to be noted, go into Dixon's at Heathrow Airport to see whether or not they would sell either a microphone that would go into my phone or a digital recording device that came with a microphone. They didn't. So I did try. So I didn't have a recording device. But even if I had, I don't think it would have worked on the basis that when I got to my hotel in Oslo, which wasn't until quite late in the day because lots of stuff was happening. So A, you would have to have stayed up quite late to record at your end.
Yeah.
And B, when I got to my hotel in Oslo, they'd given away my room. So I didn't I didn't have a room in which to stay.
You could have recorded it outside.
In the street.
Once again, that's Chris Cook vetoing that.
In the freezing cold.
At that time I wanted to record walking around a park in the snow, and you said no.
No. So
it was more like rain, wasn't it? It was snow.
Well, it was snow in Oslo, obviously, because it was snow everywhere last week, and B, it's always snow at this time of year in Oslo. So I didn't have a hotel room. I'm not going to go on about that, because I moaned about it on Facebook. I wrote an angry letter to the CEO of the group, who, to be fair, responded really quickly, as did the MD of the Norwegian division. So I feel that I shouldn't be giving them a bad time, because although it was very annoying at the time when I got there at the hotel in Oslo and I said, I'm Chris, I'm here to check in. And they said, we're fully booked. Full stop. And it was like, yeah, I booked. I'm one of the bookings within your fully booked. And it took quite a while for it to turn out that they were fully booked and had given away my room. But anyway, the point is, even if I'd had my recording device in my bag, it probably wouldn't have worked. So therefore, I actually think, with hindsight, it was your fault for 2 weeks ago not saying, yeah, podcast's not going to be recorded next week. We should just take a week off. So I think the responsibility stops with the editor. The buck always does stop with the editor. Let's not forget that. That's the ethos within the media industry, that the editor's decision is final.
Yeah,
and so it's always his fault.
The media industry is bullshit, isn't it? So I don't hold with that at all.
Well, as we're about to discuss, the media industry is also fucked. But that's another story. So we took an impromptu week off. But hey, it's not like anything happened last week of any importance. So it doesn't matter that we took a week off.
Not like a story we've been waiting to talk about for about 8 years. We'll get onto that, though.
Yes, there was so actually...
Thankfully, that story's still rolling on.
There was, as it turns out, because since the start of the year, there have been a couple of weeks where we've been pushing our luck with the podcast. In fact, to the extent that when I did my Dissecting the Digital Dollar talk at BLARM, there was someone there in the audience who's a regular listener to the podcast, and he said, yeah, I pretty much knew everything you said because I listened to the podcast. And over a number of weeks, you've delivered that lecture. I think what he was, he didn't actually say this, but I think what he was basically saying was, not only have you delivered that lecture in sections on the podcast, you've done it several times. But he said the slides were nice. So, you know, there's always always an extra little benefit. But yeah, something quite big did happen last week, but we're making that the second story of this week's podcast, I believe.
Yes. So let's get on with, well, I'm going to reveal what that story is, and that even though you've now sort of built it up with a bit of mystery, like, oh, we'll tell you in 10 minutes time what that is. No, I'm going to say now.
You're going to immediately smash the little clever mystique that I built there.
Yes. And given that this show has a format that it sticks to every week, you should have known that I was about to do that.
Spotify's SEC filing. See, I got in there. Now I've ruined it for you after you ruined it for me.
No, there's no, I've got no comeback. But anyway, coming up this week, Spotify prepares for its stock market listing, and consumer rights bodies around the world question what the hell Viagogo is even doing. But first, the enemy is dead. Sort of, a bit.
What's interesting there is that you've sort of taken it to the other extreme. Their official announcement was very spun in a way to try and turn this negative story into a positive.
Yes.
Whereas you've taken it to the other extreme to make it sound like it's completely and utterly no more. And neither of those things are really true.
Yes, the official statement from Time Inc. UK last week was that the enemy is expanding its digital first strategy, by which it means it's closing down its print magazine.
Yeah, for digital first, read digital only.
Yes. Well, they're going to do like one-off magazines every now and then. I think that's how they kind of justified saying, oh, we're doing a more of a digital first strategy. But the weekly magazine is, well, as of now, when you're listening to this podcast, no more.
Because, well, you say that, but it's a weekly magazine. So the one that came out last Friday, in essence, does last till next Thursday.
Well, all right. No.
Well, I suppose now it's a free magazine, whereas in the olden days, that was definitely true because you could still go to the newsagent to buy it. I suppose, I assume it did sit in, see, I'm using the past tense. I assume it did sit in piles somewhere. I only ever saw it being handed out by people at the tube station.
I think you can pick it up in shops.
So it is still available for a few more days. And then, in print, in a weekly form, the enemy will be no more.
Yes, but my point was that this announcement wasn't like, oh, we're going to wind this down and, you know, in a few months' time, we're going to stop doing it. It was like, as of now, look, we've already started writing this week's one, so we might as well do that. But after that, nothing, nothing at all. We're going to just stop doing it.
Yes, and in that statement, after spinning the digital first line, and then talking about how successful the free version of Enemy had been, because,
yeah,
of course,
really, really talking it up.
Enemy, as a paid-for title, saw dramatic, significant declines in its circulation year on year, quarter to quarter, month on month, from the early 2000s, so that it was selling fewer and fewer copies, to the point that it was like, it can't be commercially viable to continue printing it when you're selling that number of copies. It then relaunched as that free title that was handed out at tube stations and shops and universities. That was, what, 3 years ago?
Yes, 2015.
Which meant that, actually, in total, its distribution figures, although they were free rather than paid for, but there were more copies going out than ever.
Yes.
Once it was a free title. And so, although the guy who oversees the sort of the music and entertainment titles at Time Inc. UK, Paul Cheel, was bigging up what had been achieved by Enemy as a free magazine, he then went into the doom and gloom paragraph, yeah, confirming there will be no weekly print Enemy from this point onwards, stating that increasing production costs and a very tough print advertising market meant that the free weekly magazine is no longer financially viable. As a quick aside, and it's something which I should have researched before I came into this podcast. In fact, I even considered researching it when I got up this morning.
Well, that's half the job done.
And then I forgot. But I was at the Green Innovations and Events Conference earlier this week, which is a great event about making festivals and large events more sustainable and environmentally friendly. I was actually there to moderate the sewage panel.
Of course.
Because
when you think of sewage, who's the first person you think of?
But someone did say, as part of another discussion, that now there is a new push against single-use plastic products,
yes,
and plastic bags, and there's going to be a ban on plastic straws at some festivals this year,
yes,
and of course plastic cups and all that. So plastic,
rightly so.
And rightly so, yes. Plastic.
People going to festivals, you are not children, you don't need straws.
So with plastic products, single-use, sort of, there being a big campaign against that, the flip side of that is that paper is back in fashion, because there's lots of things that people are using plastic products that could be paper or cardboard products. So the demand for paper and sort of tree-based products in general is on the up. So I suspect paper prices are going to go up because the demand is going to go up. And that could be the nail in the coffin for lots of people in sort of the print magazine sector, because they are operating on such tight profit margins these days. And so if the paper prices significantly go up, that will have an impact on them. And we could see other titles finally. I'm not saying that's what has happened here, but it may well be a factor, because he did say production costs are going up and making it no longer financially viable.
So as you said, by the time they decided to make it a free title in 2015, the circulation of the paid-for magazine had dropped drastically in the preceding years. You know, you were seeing like 15 to 20% drops year on year in circulation every time the ABC figures came out. And by the time they made that decision to go free, it was selling less than 14,000 copies a week, which, considering its last peak, it had been over 100,000. Its heyday in the 60s, it was over 300,000. And as a free title, it went on to shift more than 300,000 copies a week, but you know, it's a free title, and a lot of people just took those out of embarrassment, didn't they? That's what happens when you give those things at tube stations. But they did talk up how they turned this around. I mean, this is in the statement that's just come out. They were talking about how this higher circulation meant they could attract bigger cover stars than they'd ever managed before. And I mean, as far as we know, until fairly recently, people who work at the NME were really still talking up like what a success story this had been and how great it was now.
Yes, and of course, it is notable that the somewhat sudden announcement that the NME would cease to be print title comes very quickly after another development that occurred recently at Time Inc. UK. Which is Time Inc. UK, which was the UK division of Time Inc., the American publishing company, was sold to a private equity division. Prior to that, Time Inc. itself in America got bought by another media company over there called Meredith. Meredith is very much focused on the American market, so we noted at the time of that deal, be interesting to see what they're going to do with the UK business, because they're not active over here. Well, what they decided to do with the UK business was to sell it off, and as they did sell it off, the private equity group who acquired it was saying that they thought there was a huge amount of potential in the various magazines that Time Inc. UK own, and it's a sizable number of magazines and a real eclectic mix too. Although sources were saying, perhaps unsurprisingly, that they expected the first thing the new owners to do was to go through the entire portfolio, and any magazines that seemed to be underperforming, they could look to either offload and sell onto someone else or ultimately shut down. We don't know whether that acquisition had any effect on the decision to shut NME as a print title with immediate effect. Although it wouldn't be surprising if that acquisition, or maybe some of the discussions and negotiations that preceded that acquisition, had had some sort of influence on this decision.
Yes, certainly. At exactly the same time the sale of Time Inc. UK was announced, NME editor Mike Williams announced that he was stepping down from the role.
And he'd been there quite a while, including overseeing the shift to becoming a free title.
Which suggests that even if the rest of the staff at the NME didn't know this was coming, he certainly did, and got out before it was too late.
It's been interesting to watch response to this on the social networks, because although, let's not forget, this is not the end of the NME, it's a shift to a digital-first strategy.
Yes.
But most people are seeing it. Well, it's definitely the end of an era, even if it's not completely the end of the NME.
Yeah, but I think the shifting to a free title was the end of an era. That's where I see the NME as I knew it as a teenager definitely being dead.
Well, I think there's two things to say there, which is, first of all, when it went free, and I think the people at work at NME will be the first to admit this. Indeed, when I've had conversations with them about it, they definitely admitted it. When it became a free title, certainly in print, it changed. Because if you are a 300,000 plus circulation free magazine that is paid for by advertising, we are in an era now where the record companies and the tour promoters, their advertising budgets are not big enough to pay for printing a magazine and distributing a magazine on that scale. So you need to pull in the big consumer brands as advertisers in order to make that work. And in order to do that, you need to pull in a more mainstream audience. So yes, for definite, the NME print magazine, as soon as it became a free title, became in essence an entertainment magazine with TV and movies, a bit celebrity in there, more mainstream acts on the cover, because that was to pull in a bigger audience so they could pull in the bigger advertisers. And I don't think anyone at NME was denying that certainly in print that was what was going on. Although I think the other interesting thing, watching the social networks and people reminiscing about the so-called heyday of NME, and one thing I've noticed, bearing in mind I was never really an NME reader when I was growing up, I never really read the NME. I went from smash hits to Record Mirror without stopping off with Enemy in the middle. And it's interesting watching people who were loyal Enemy readers at some point in their life, probably their late teens, early 20s, because that is the demographic that Enemy has always been aimed at, certainly before it became a free title. It was. Most people seem to be saying, well, Enemy lost it, and then they would declare a period in history in which they ceased to be in the demographic. So they was like, oh, the Enemy's never been the same since 2006. Or, oh, well, the Enemy, it kind of lost it in the early 90s, didn't it? And I saw one person saying, oh, the Enemy lost it, you know, by the late 80s, it just wasn't the title it used to be. So I think in some cases, people are sort of saying, oh, the Enemy, it was great in the era when it was aimed at me. And once I ceased to be part of its target demographic, then I think it went rubbish.
Well, yeah, but that's the traditional way that people look at all pop culture, isn't it? It's not as good as it was when I was the target market for that thing.
Yeah, the best new music came out when I was 17, obviously, is a position a lot of people say. But although I think, as I say, a lot of people on my social feeds were writing off the Enemy from the point at which it ceased to be for them, I think most people would agree, and actually probably quite a lot of people who are still working or have worked very recently for the Enemy would agree, that when it became a free title, certainly in print, well, it definitely changed.
Yes.
I think would be the diplomatic way of saying it. And it ceased to be the sort of cutting-edge indie rock magazine that would have the big indie stars on the cover and then be championing all the new artists and the things that might be big in a couple of years' time towards the back of the magazine. It stopped to be that, certainly in print. I think Enemy, Time Inc. UK would argue that there was still plenty of that online. I think there probably was. You may have had to dig for it at enemy.com. And of course, the other part of this press release on the back of the digital first strategy, as well as saying how well this free magazine that they're now shutting down had gone, was to big up enemy.com, because obviously that is the future of the brand.
Yes, and they're saying they're shutting down the magazine so that they can put more investment into developing the website and various online elements of the brand. They reckon they've doubled their global audience online in the last year. And it was already, in terms of music media, Enemy's always had a big online following. And it was one of the early music brands to move online and have its own website.
Yes, they were bigging up the 20 years that Enemy have had an active presence online. So they were one of the first magazines.
But I think it's more than that.
Well, you should take that up with whoever wrote the press release.
I will.
From Time Inc. UK. But certainly, as you say, as a magazine, they were one of the first to brace online, to put quite a lot of the magazine's content online, and to start creating extra content, all the sort of new stuff that didn't used to make sense even in a weekly magazine that does make sense on a website. So certainly enemy.com was one of the first of the music sites that came out of an existing print title rather than being an online only music magazine that emerged in the early days of the web. And it has always done pretty well in terms of audience. I suppose the Enemy is facing the same issue as pretty much every other magazine in the world. And we talked about this last year with our media conference at The Great Escape. And a couple of years ago, when we did our session on all things media and music media at the Convergence Festival in London, of which there are still some interviews.
Yes, somewhere. You go back through this podcast feed, you'll find it.
In the podcast archives. But what we talked about at all of those things is the challenge for all newspaper and magazine owners is that as everything has shifted online, as people are shifting online, if, as a newspaper owner, a magazine owner, you embrace the web, which by now most have, and you put most of your print content on your website and a whole load of extra content on your website too, ultimately, if you do that well and you've got an existing brand, you will probably end up talking to more people online than you ever did in print. Even in the heyday of magazines and newspapers, whenever that was, you're probably talking to more people now online than you ever did. But actually, most print newspapers and magazines, even though in terms of audience, their websites are way bigger than their print product, probably make more money out of their print newspaper, print magazine, than they do the website through a combination of what they get at the newsagent and the advertising. Because it's really hard to make money out of websites.
Yes.
Because you can try selling adverts like you do in your magazine, but most internet advertising money goes to Google and Facebook. So it's actually really hard to get any of that money. You could try charging a subscription, the equivalent of a cover price, but really when it comes to consumer magazines, business titles, you can do that. But consumer magazines, nobody really has managed to do that. Some of the broadsheet newspapers are just about working out how to make that work, but only now. And when it comes to entertainment, I'm not aware of any site that has managed to do that, a magazine or a newspaper with more sort of celebrity entertainment news, people actually paying for the content. So what else do you do? And that's what we talked about last year at The Great Escape. Do you become a ticketing company? Obviously, Resident Advisor have built a very successful ticketing business. Do you do the whole branded content thing like Vice do? Do you build a sort of a brand agency on the side like Clash Magazine have done? Do you take your brand and try and build other products around the world and franchise it out like DJ Mag have done? How do you make money out of online music media? And I think NME, with a younger demographic than, say, a Q or a Mojo, have hit that first. But every newspaper and pretty much every magazine is facing this challenge. And we'll be watching whether NME can make online-only work. Because if they can, then maybe some other magazines will follow suit. If it all goes horribly, horribly wrong, then I don't really know what is the future for print music magazines.
Well, that's a nice upbeat way to end this section of the show. Can magazines survive in any format whatsoever?
Maybe the future is podcasts.
Maybe. That's not what they say, isn't
it? Not that we've made any money out of our podcast, but you never know.
Send in some money
and
to us.
Prove that. There you go. Prove that podcasts are the future.
You can, just send us a fiver in the post. Still to come, some news in brief, plus the latest round of official secondary ticketing dissing. But now, as we mentioned at the start of the show, our impromptu week off meant that we missed Spotify filing documentation for its stock market listing in New York.
Finally submitting that documentation.
Yes.
To the SEC in America, paving its way for a direct listing on the New York Stock Exchange. So, you almost certainly know this because
yes.
Spotify going public. It's not just a music business story. It's not just a music story. It's not just a tech story. It's not just a business story. It's an everything story. So obviously, this is getting an awful lot of press. As soon as that document was filed, when a company goes public, and indeed once a company becomes public, it has to declare lots of things about its business and its stats and its finances that you wouldn't normally get access to as a private business. So obviously, we're all scrutinizing this to see if there are any nuggets, any secrets that we didn't know about. In some ways, most what was in the document kind of confirmed what we already knew in terms of how the company is doing and what its ambitions are. In terms of some of the figures that were in there, it said that if you took the value at which shares in the company have been trading privately and you were to do it at the upper level of what things have been trading, then the company has a valuation of about $23 billion. So people were thinking that it might be a $20 billion valuation by the time it listed.
Yeah.
So if you do it at the lower end of private trading, it would be less than $23 billion, obviously, but the highest would be $23 billion. And in terms of the users, it said that there were 71 million paying subscribers. So I think the last figure we had officially was 70 million,
yes.
Wasn't it? But we know they're adding about a million a month, so that's not surprising. And overall, 150 million monthly active users in total. So those are sort of the top level stats, but there were lots of other bits of nitty gritty in there.
So yeah, while talking up their 71 million paying subscribers, they noted their closest rival is Apple Music, which has like 36 million paying subscribers, and that's its total because it doesn't have a free tier like Spotify does. And so sort of started off saying, we are so dominant, we're so much bigger than anyone else, and then moved on to, but actually Apple does pose a threat to us. And so do other services that we haven't thought of being competition yet. So there are risks to being an investor in Spotify. At the moment, we're doing well, though, so that's fine. But it noted, that we talked recently about the fact that Apple is lined up to overtake Spotify's user numbers in the US and around this summer at their current rates of growth. And also they talked about the Apple tax, which gives Apple an advantage over other third-party developers like Spotify and the other streaming services. I mean, they talked about Apple and Google, but Apple's the one they're particularly worried about because obviously Apple takes a 30% cut of any sales through its App Store for a streaming service. That's their entire profit margin. So all the streaming services have to put 30% on top of their price if you buy your subscription through the app on your iPhone. But they're not allowed to say that's happening. So it looks to someone who's not kind of technically minded enough to go and look at the Spotify website and check that Spotify is just 30% more expensive than Apple Music.
Yeah, there's a double frustration with the commission that Apple charges on purchases through the App Store in that, as you say, it means that if you buy a Spotify subscription through the Apple ecosystem, it's 30% higher. That's annoying. But also, Apple won't let you tell people as you're doing that. Do you know if you went to Spotify.com and did the transaction there and then logged in for your Apple device, you'll be able to do it at £10, $10, €10 a month rather than 13. So yeah, that has been a frustration for quite some time. Of all of the services that are not Apple services, Google has a similar thing on its App Store, although it's not quite as draconian in terms of the rules around communication. So it does tend to be Apple that people gripe about. But it's interesting with documents like this, because on one level, they're obviously in sales pitch mode. They've got to convince people everything's great. But at the same time, because it is for potential investors, you do have to go through potential risks down the line. And so they were being quite upfront of saying, we see Apple because it has this advantage, and potentially Google, it's not huge in subscription music yet, but it will also have this advantage. And maybe other either tech giants moving into music or some startups down the line that could become significant competitors as the market matures. And they were very much stressing that in their document.
Another interesting thing was how they framed the ad-funded part of their service.
Which we tend to write off.
Yes.
And say you make all the money on premium subscriptions, the ad-funded freemium platform, it's just there to upsell subscriptions. You'll never make any money out of it. Would be my position on Spotify.
Which is sort of true and sort of not. In terms of their revenues, they made $5 billion last year, and about a tenth of that came from ad-funded subscribers. So they're bringing in $500 million a year. Or they're saying that actually that figure is growing. It was up nearly double in 2017 versus 2016. So that area of the business is growing, but it is still a tenth of their overall revenues. They're making a lot more off premium subscribers.
Yeah, and that's revenue, not profit. And although ultimately streaming is a revenue share,
there is no profit.
Well, I know, but I think the royalty commitments being made to the music industry, particularly with things like the minimum guarantees and stuff like that, the advertising side does seem more risky. Also, the royalties you pay on a free stream are less than on a premium stream. But in the main, A, the revenues are a lot less on advertising. B, the profitability, it's harder to see how that side will ever work. But you're right, certainly in this document, they were not writing off free. And they were saying, we still think there are huge opportunities in free. We still think there's ways that we could be bringing in more advertising income. I'm not sure they're necessarily right. It is true that certain emerging markets are so dominated by free and look like they're going to be dominated by free for the foreseeable future. It will be a real niche audience who pay to stream. I suppose as those emerging markets become more important, then you have to perhaps prioritise the ad-funded side of your business. But I think in Europe and North America, it seems to me the business really is premium streaming. There might be something in the branded content thing around actually working with brands to create content a bit like what Vice do. There could be some growth there. But I was at BLOM, obviously, a couple of days after this was put out. So I was asking various people there, what do you think are the other future revenue streams? Do you think the advertising, there's a lot of room for growth there? Most people seem to be agreeing with me that ultimately it's a premium subscriptions play. And that is where they're going to have to put their effort. But officially, at least, Spotify don't agree with us for the time being, at least.
Yes. So filing all that documentation out of the way, Spotify now has to prepare for actually going public. So it's doing various things at the moment. The one thing it's building up to is, well, they're not doing the traditional IPO where you release a load of new shares and you let people buy them. They're doing a direct listing, which is an unusual thing, which people seem to be split on whether or not it's going to be successful or not. But basically, you just let people who already own shares start trading them. And that's how that works. It's slightly different to when you do an IPO, slightly easier in some ways. But one of the things you do as an IPO is basically do a tour of potential investors and do your pitch to them and try to convince them that when the shares go on sale, they should buy them. And then you can collect a load of information about who those people are, who's likely to invest, and kind of build up a picture of, I mean, that's sort of how they do the valuation. You build up a picture of who your potential customers for your shares are. But they're not doing that, so they're not doing the tour. Instead, and perhaps fittingly, they're going to live stream their investor pitch, which is, like I say, it seems fitting. Also, it's a lot easier than going around lots of different places and pitching. You've got to do the pitch once, and that's fine.
Also, that means it will be public domain, where usually those investor briefings are sort of behind closed doors. And I suppose to an extent, because they're going this weird direct listing route, which most of us didn't even know was an option until Spotify announced they were going to do it. They're not the first people to do it, but it is unusual. But I suppose ultimately, they're not selling the shares. The existing shareholders are selling the shares. So it's for the existing shareholders to go out and tell people how brilliant Spotify is and why you should be buying shares in it. But they are going to do this live stream where I assume that will be a presentation version of what we read in the SEC filing. Obviously, we'll all be tuning in to see if they reveal anything that as isn't in that document, but I doubt that there will be.
Obviously, like you say, it's the existing shareholders who are going to be selling the shares, not Spotify itself. And some of those existing shareholders are the major record labels who all own equity in the streaming service.
Yes, and of course they got that equity, as did the indie label repping Merlin, through their initial licensing deals. So it's not that they bought shares early on, it's that as part of their licensing deals, when they first allowed Spotify to utilize their content, part of the deal was equity. And once Spotify lists the majors and Murder on behalf of the indies, will at some point, not necessarily immediately, but at some point, will be able to sell their shares. A big payday, a whole lot of cash will come in to Sony, Universal, Warner, and then will be distributed around Merlin's members. And of course, for quite some time now, one of the conversations has been, okay, when that new money flows into the record industry, the labels get some, but do the artists get some? And this conversation was sort of big. Well, the indies put out their...
It's reared its head various times over the last few years.
Yeah, so
because
the...
Because we've talked about Spotify going public so many times.
Exactly.
It's been imminent for about 5 years.
It has. And the World Independent Network, which brings together sort of the indie label community, put out their Fair Deals Declaration in 2014,
yes.
I think. And that included the commitment that wherever a label earns a chunk of money off a streaming service, which isn't directly attributed to plays, but is based on the value of their catalogue, that they would share that with their artists. And then subsequently, a few years later, Warner Music, in a finance briefing, just dropped it. Oh, of course, we'll be sharing our chunk of equity money with our artists.
Yep, and then Sony followed suit.
They did with a, of course we're going to share the money statement, even though in an earlier bit of litigation between Sony and 19, they'd been much less up for that idea. Universal Music resisted the temptation to put out a statement at that time. We had heard that off the record they had indicated to managers and lawyers of artists that they would make a similar commitment. But it was only as the documents were filed at the SEC that Music Business Worldwide called them up and said, okay, are you going to commit now? And they said, yes, we will share with our artists. There's then the second question, which has also come up previously, which is, okay, so the labels are all committing to share the money with their artists. What about the indie labels, which are distributed by a division of Sony or a division of Warner or a division of Universal? Will the majors share the money with the distributed labels so that the distributed labels can share it with their artists? And so that's another thing that the indie label community have been shouting about. And now we've got a commitment that Sony will.
Yes.
We're waiting for Universal and Warner. I suspect they will probably follow suit. It has to be said that the legalities of this are debatable as to whether or not there is a legal obligation on all of this money to be shared out. You'd have to go digging into the nitty-gritty of individual artists and label-to-distributor contracts. But I think certainly for PR reasons, I think ultimately this money will get shared across the board. Of course, as it gets shared out across everybody, well, first of all, what does that even mean?
Well, yeah, it's one thing saying, well, of course, we'll share the money, but no one has actually said on what basis. So it could just be like, yeah, well, of course, we'll keep 99% for ourselves and then 1% can go between all of these indie labels and all the artists. And that'll be fine. They can like that. There's a bit of money for them.
We'll send you all a £50 record token. Because record tokens are coming back.
Well, apparently.
Which we talked about on a podcast recently. And I had confirmation of that this week. Also, as it gets shared out across the entire music community, as it should do, even if it gets shared out in an equitable fashion, which it may or it may not, because it's now being shared out across everybody, it may well be that when finally these shares are sold and the money flows through the system and everybody gets their checks, there's going to be a lot of disappointed people because once that money gets slashed, I mean, it's a lot of money, but then it's not that much money compared to how much money is coming from Spotify every year into the music industry. So it might be that finally when those equity payments come in, given that people have been anticipating this for so long now.
Well, that's it, isn't it? This topic keeps coming up and it's based on the idea that there will be a significant amount of money to go around everyone. And you're talking about going around all of the indie labels who are distributed by major labels, which that's a lot of indie labels. All of the artists signed to major labels, that's a lot of artists. It could be that Spotify listed on the New York Stock Exchange in a couple of weeks' time, share prices immediately tank and there's no money for anyone and no one wants to sell their shares.
Well, that's the other thing is we don't know how quickly the labels will sell their shares. We don't know whether they'll sell them all in one go. Obviously, they don't have to. They might choose to sell them in sections. And there are all sorts of questions about how you share out this money. I mean, what about if you're Sony, Universal, Warner? There will be plenty of indie labels who you have distributed in the last 10 years, but you're not distributing anymore. Are you still going to share money with them, even though you don't have a current life business relationship with them? I mean, you probably should, but will you?
Or the same with artists who've been dropped.
Yes. So who knows what will happen? So commitments coming in from all over the place. We're still waiting for the last couple, but a lot of commitments on sharing this money. But it will be interesting to see how much money are we really talking about, certainly once it's been sliced and diced between everybody, and how will the labels make good on that commitment to share this money. So I think this is going to be something we'll be talking about a lot this year as this listing finally happens, and at some point, who knows when, a load of money comes through and everyone gets their £50 record tokens from the record industry.
Just quickly, time for some news in brief now. Apple is phasing out the iTunes LP, which is apparently a thing that still existed anyway. And that has prompted everyone to say, oh, the iTunes store is dead. Downloads are dead.
Yeah, the iTunes LP. I had completely forgotten about the iTunes LP. It was big news for a good 3 weeks in 2009 when they first brought it. Actually, I think it was 2008 when they brought it out. All I remember about the iTunes LP is that when the Beatles finally did a deal with Apple, and so finally their music arrived on iTunes, which I think probably was 2009, maybe 2010. There were some iTunes LPs as part of that because people were still excited about iTunes. It was basically the digital album with some nonsense multimedia stuff thrown in for no apparent reason.
Well, like they used to do on CDs years ago.
I have a couple of albums and or EPs I downloaded from iTunes years ago where a video came as part of it. And now it's sort of really annoying because if you play your sort of MP3s through the Apple Music app, every so often the video starts playing, and often the sound levels on the video are a lot quieter than they would be on a track. And so it's just really annoying. So I'm glad that the iTunes LP
good
is
riddance.
No more.
Although it does, I mean, I don't know how many iTunes LPs are even being released anymore. How much anyone cares. I mean, is anyone buying something off iTunes because it's got a bit of bonus content?
I'm not sure they ever did, even at the peak of the iTunes store. I don't think they are in 2018.
So while I think we would both agree that the iTunes store is ultimately in its terminal stage
as a seller of music,
I don't think that Apple canning the iTunes LP is necessarily a signal that that's happening sooner rather than later.
No, I think it's a confirmation that nobody in the music industry nor in the download buying public care about a little bit of multimedia being glued to the side of a digital album.
Billy McFarland, co-founder of Fyre Festival, has pleaded guilty to fraud in his financing of that disastrous event. He, as part of a plea deal, has agreed with the prosecutors would recommend a sentence of 8 to 10 years, although the judge does not have to take that recommendation and could sentence him to the maximum 40 years he is potentially facing.
Yeah, so after the Fyre Festival collapsed just as it was kicking off last year, we talked about the plethora of litigation that followed after that. So he and his co-founder Ja Rule were sued by everybody basically in the world. But more serious than that, arguably, was, yeah, the criminal charges of fraud in relation to the way that he dealt with his investors. And yeah, that's the latest development on that.
He's due to be sentenced in June. Sticking with fraud, Martin Shkreli, who is also currently awaiting sentencing for fraud, might have to give up his Wu-Tang Clan album.
Yeah, his fraud is not really in relation to the music industry because he's not really the music industry.
No.
We call him Music News because, obviously, having come to global fame after having his pharmaceutical business that bought that drug that was particularly important for AIDS patients and then hiking up the price, something absolutely insanely, unethically ridiculous. So that's how he became a global name. But then he did start dabbling in some music stuff and he was the person who...
Well, I think he'd long dabbled in music, it's just no one knew who he was.
And he bought that one-off Wu-Tang Clan album, by which I mean they only made one copy and they sold it to him for $2 million. We thought he'd sold it on last year.
He put it on eBay and he sold it for $1 million in theory, but apparently that sale never went through.
He did get jailed about 2 days after.
Yeah, that didn't help.
eBay auction reached its conclusion. So seemingly it's still in his possession. So in addition to facing a jail term for these fraud charges, courts are also going to fine him something like $7 million. That's in addition to any civil litigation that may come from the people who he defrauded.
Yes.
And so the courts have said, OK, we may need to seize your assets as part of this. And one of those assets is the Wu-Tang album.
So you can read more about all of those stories and all of the stories we discussed this week at setlistpodcast.com, where you find the show notes to this show and links to all of them. And finally, this week, some good old secondary ticketing news. Is it ever out of the news? No, not really. But, you know, some weeks we decide to talk about it. Some weeks we don't. Some weeks I'm completely bored of it. Some weeks some government bodies make amusing statements about it and I decide that we can stick it in. So, yeah, there have been some pretty bold statements about secondary ticketing services this week, particularly Viagogo, it being the James Bond baddie of the secondary ticketing industry.
That's suggesting that one of the secondary ticketing platforms is a James Bond goodie.
Yeah, I've not thought that through. That wasn't in the script. I went off script and it's all gone wrong.
All gone horribly wrong. So, yes, we talked a great length.
Well, wait a minute. What about the ethical secondary ticketing?
Yeah, sense? Well done. If only you'd thought of that as an immediate comeback rather than having already admitted defeat. That would have
been luckily,
good.
Well, luckily, the process of editing, I'm sure, will mean this ends up with me sounding great.
I wouldn't be so certain about that. So, yes, we've discussed at length on Setlist how with secondary ticketing... Well, it's interesting. I was down at the ILMC, the big live music conference, last week, and we were talking about this, how with the whole secondary ticketing debate, it feels like a few years ago at an event like that, which is all live music people, the secondary ticketing conversation went, we don't like secondary ticketing, but we tried to stop it, it failed, so we just have to learn to live with it.
Yeah.
Whereas in the last few years, lots of new initiatives have come about, and it does feel like that there is an eagerness amongst the industry, well, some of the industry, and amongst lawmakers to try and regulate secondary ticketing in some way. And various governments and government institutions are certainly talking tough about secondary ticketing. Whether or not they're really doing anything is another debate. But we've seen stuff happening, well, in Australia last year and now in New Zealand. So Viagogo was in the news in New Zealand last week because that Bruno Mars that you love so much was playing concerts there. And a whole load of people had bought tickets for the shows on Viagogo. They didn't get in. The local newspapers were all talking about fake tickets, but yeah. I suspect it wasn't. I mean, they could have been fraudulently sold fake tickets. That can happen. But it could also have been that the promoter was cracking down and cancelling touted tickets. Either way, quite a lot of people didn't get into the show. And on one night, about 70 people were turned away. One of those people was a guy who's a writer over there, and he seemed to rally everyone together and made a bit of a news story about it. And on the back of that, the Commerce Commission in New Zealand put out a statement. They were already investigating Viagogo, but they basically put out a statement saying, well, if you're stupid enough to use Viagogo, bad things will happen. They were basically saying, don't buy tickets on Viagogo in a slightly, but not entirely diplomatic way.
No, not really diplomatic at all. They said that consumers should seriously consider whether buying tickets from Viagogo is worth the risk. Then they outlined basically why it definitely isn't worth the risk. They said that in total recently they've had 228 complaints about Viagogo. And then over one weekend earlier this month, they had a big spike of complaints, which I think Bruno Mars' show was part of that big spike. That's 70 people right there. And so although they were already investigating, this is what prompted them to kind of go public with the progress of that investigation. The Commission's Stuart Wallace said that is currently seeking expert legal advice on whether and how they can enforce New Zealand consumer laws against Viagogo because the company's based in Switzerland, which is a problem that government bodies like this are having around the world. He also noted that government bodies around the world are also trying to deal with this and looked at what they're doing, particularly citing Australia, where the Competition and Consumer Commission has already, as we said, launched legal action.
Those other government bodies around the world who have likewise been talking tough on secondary ticketing in general or Viagogo specifically include here in the UK, where we've seen both the National Trading Standards Organisation and the Competition and Markets Authority launching investigations in this space. If I remember rightly, the CMA is looking at the sites, whereas National Trading Standards are actually investigating the people who sell tickets on the sites. But the news last week was nothing to do with any of them. It was the advertising industry's own regulator, the Advertising Standards Authority. It is also laying into the secondary ticketing market, partly based on how the secondary sites list and explain their pricing. And the fact that unlike the primary sites that also used to do this, but which have generally cleaned up their act in terms of adding a load of fees at the very last stage of buying your ticket. Yeah. So they're basically saying these sites need to be upfront from the first screen as the total price the ticket's
going
to cost.
Well, also some of those fees can be huge. You know, they can be bigger than the ticket price itself.
Yeah, they do seem to add like hundreds of pounds sometimes to the purchase. So they were saying all secondary sites are bad at this, and so the resale sites must start listing the full ticket price on the first screen. And then they also had some specific dissing of Viagogo, which are things that people like the Fanfare campaign have raised earlier. The fact that Viagogo use words like official site and 100% guarantee, which some people then infer as meaning that Viagogo is an official site that can provide a 100% guarantee.
Yes.
For some reason.
And it is and can do neither of those things.
They would come back with arguments of exactly how they use those two terms. But I think when you see official site and you see 100% guarantee and you don't read the small print around them, it is fair to assume that that means that Viagogo is an approved primary ticket agent, which it is not. And the 100% guarantee means you will definitely get into the show.
Which you will not.
Which,
you may. There's not a 100% guarantee.
And in fact, compared to buying a ticket off a primary site, where there probably still isn't a 100% guarantee, but there's a pretty damn good guarantee. As we know, as more and more promoters start taking action to cancel touted tickets, it's nothing like a 100% guarantee that you will get in the show if you buy your tickets on Viagogo. And so the ASA was saying to Viagogo, stop doing that!
Yes, it was reported that they've ordered Viagogo to stop doing this. But as we've seen in the past, Viagogo doesn't tend to listen very much to people telling them things.
No, and the ASA is the advertising industry's own regulator, not a government institution, and Viagogo often ignores government institutions.
Yeah.
So as the Fanfare campaign here in the UK is always keen to point out, it's great that organisations like this are talking tough, and it's great that new rules and new laws have been passed, but somebody somewhere has to enforce these, which ultimately, it seems, of a company like Viagogo, who are very good at just basically ignoring everybody, that does ultimately mean taking them to court, as we are seeing happening in Australia. So it will be interesting to see, as this year pans out, how much of these rules and regulations are actually properly enforced. If we assume, I mean, you never know, suddenly overnight, Viagogo might start obeying all these rules, but let's assume that they sort of stay with form and they're certainly not obeying all of them. Will somebody actually go legal to properly enforce them?
Well, we'll see. But we haven't got time to wait for that to happen because we have run out of time on this week's show. If you have a moment yourself now, how about you go and rate us on iTunes? That would be very helpful in getting the word out to other people if you're one of those people who just doesn't want to tell lots of people in the street to listen to this show, which you should also do. If you've already rated us before, thanks very much. But you know, you can rate again with every new episode and you should do that. So please do it again. And if you want to write a review as well, that's good. We'd like that, but you know, no pressure. It's fine. If you haven't already, subscribe to the show wherever you like to get your podcasts and tell all your friends if you're not going to tell people in the street. This show is presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Petey. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. For more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an unlimited production.